One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome back to The Lost Cast. It's good to have you guys. Jamie Slevin joins me again this week. It's good to have you, Jamie.
Lawrence, hey mate, how's it going?
Not bad. We were talking down in the, it's like a cafe where we go and get coffee before the show. Is it really a show? Yeah, before the meeting, which we record. And we were talking about, I don't know how it came up, but something called ELO, not Electronic Light Orchestra, but...
ELO.
Meaning?
Meaning. A standard system of judging games and participants in games.
More standardized.
Yeah, so right. This is most often seen in chess.
Yep.
So to rank players, rather than having a tennis ranking, mm-hmm. where you'll have Djokovic at number two and Alcaraz now at number one, congratulations to him. You'll instead have a bunch of chess players with ratings, and those ratings tend to be between about 1,000 and 2,000. And it turns out, after some weekend Googling, that doesn't just apply to chess players, but indeed football clubs and football managers.
And that you can, I don't know, like it kind of feels like this, there's so many different ways of ranking people in the modern game. There's so many what I look at so often and go, seems a little bit like you've got a small sample size of stuff there. Like even a season kind of feels a little bit like a small sample size for someone like Pep Guardiola or something like that, or Jurgen Klopp or any of these guys. So when you told me about it, I instantly went to this, my mind instantly went to this place of, wow, what are we dealing with here? And why don't we know more about this? Especially in like a stats-based age, right?
Yeah, well, there's something interesting philosophically off the bat, which is that when we usually rank footballers or football clubs, we're not meaning to do it quantitatively. When you say Klopp is better than Guardiola or any kind of qualitative statement, it is in fact qualitative. You're not trying to be descriptive mathematically. You're saying, hey, given that he's one X or he's one Y, there's no objective criteria that we've agreed on or written down. There's nothing mathematical, which is weird because in some ways we're so stats-based.
But the mathematics of it does come into it somehow, because if they weren't winning things mathematically, they wouldn't be in the conversation. So what we're looking for is things beyond the current maths that we have access to. Because part of me also feels like every time that we get a new piece of maths that we can plug into the system, our understanding gets a little bit not better, but like it's maybe expanded a little bit. And therefore, you know, I guess the not the magic remains, but the unknowable quantities maybe shift.
Yeah. And this is where something like ELO or any mathematical rating system has pros and cons. On the one hand, it's kind of nice to say, hey, Twitter, which is really noisy, we have an answer to this question. The downside.
I love that tweet, by the way. That tweet was like, bang.
The downside, though, is the criteria themselves do all the heavy lifting.
Right.
So whether you weight the Carabao Cup as, and we'll get into this in a second, as plus five or plus 10, will then dictate how highly you rate someone like Pep Guardiola, who's had the advantage of winning four or five Carabao Cups.
So within this, what we're kind of coming up with now is that Elo was basically giving you, it's like a mean or an average of how well a club is actually doing, and not just kind of, hey, you beat a club, that's worth 3 points. Because that's often what I guess people struggle with, right? Like, obviously at one point, and you studied this recently, 2 points became 3 points in the league system. And that was to incentivize basically better, more attacking football, wasn't it? Although actually what it didn't really incentivize that.
Yeah, it's such an interesting story. So there was this worry as football entered the 50s and 60s that it was getting slower and more cynical. And one of the solutions that was suggested by the Coventry City chairman was, hey, well, instead of a win being worth 2 points, what if we say it's now worth three? It's intuitive too, because you'd think, well, if the game's 1-1, let's start attacking. So that's what they did.
And who was the Coventry chairman at the time?
Oh, his name escapes me.
Jimmy Hill?
It was Jimmy Hill.
Yeah.
Jimmy Hill.
I watched your video. It was good.
Oh, thanks, mate.
I like Jimmy Hill as well. So.
Yeah, Jimmy Hill was a broadcaster, obviously, later. And I didn't know that he was a broadcaster.
So I know him only the other way. I thought he was only a broadcaster. I mean, not only a broadcaster, but like obviously as a kid, you see him and he's just one of those older men. He seems to have looked that way his entire life.
Yeah, like the Graham Souness complex.
Right. Although Graham Souness has looked incredible his whole life. Like Graham Souness still looks incredible. It's kind of problematic, really, that he and others from a Scottish background, whilst at Liverpool, called themselves the Master Race. But less about that.
Did they really?
Maybe I'm making a false... I think I'm making an accurate accusation. There were times where that has been levelled at some of the Scottish contingent at Liverpool, that they were... Just because they were so dominant, they called themselves the Master Race. Well, like, and that, I guess back then that was maybe slightly more... I can't understand why it was more palatable, but it probably was.
It's like that bit in The Thick of It, where Ollie's like, why is everyone in Scottish?
Right, yeah. Because there's just something inherently in those guys. Yeah, maybe we shouldn't call them the Master Race.
Probably not.
Yeah. Sorry, go back to it then. So he basically was incentivizing, they wanted more attacking football, more interesting football. But what you found was that it was actually, they were incentivizing a different way of playing the game, which wasn't necessarily more watchable, can I put it that way?
Yeah, so it's an interesting thing. Whenever you create an incentive, there's always this mirrored effect.
Right.
So on the one hand, awesome, a win is worth more points. There's no reason at all why we shouldn't be more attacking.
Let's go for it. Like, it's better. It's way, way better. It's 50% better.
Right. But in being 50% better, you have 50% more to lose once you're a goal up. And these incentives apply in economics and they apply all over the place. There's always a double-edged sword. And in the footballing context here, what that actually meant was, if you were a goal up, it wasn't worth trying to make it two. Because the perceived risk in being attacking was now so great. You were going to lose 2 points if you conceded, rather than just losing one.
Right, that's so interesting, because actually, I guess that's how it's shaped modern football to a degree now, where... When we look at modern managers, you know, we almost don't think of them, apart from maybe Mourinho going 1-0 up and then going, let's just sit on that. Allegri does it too. So Allegri and Mourinho, I'd argue, maybe there's some Italian coaches I don't know about or some people like that, but predominantly if Liverpool's 1-0 up, actually maybe until very recently, maybe the last two seasons, Liverpool have sat much more on 1-0s, but they would always be trying to get that second goal. There's always the incentive from a Klopp or a Pep perspective of let's go 2-0 up.
Yeah, so tactically, because of the way teams play, right, and the amount of philosophy that's behind the way they play, we've actually outgrown that cynicism in some ways. But where we haven't outgrown it is the deflation you feel emotionally in conceding a last minute equalizer. You feel like you've lost 2 points. Now, that was different when it was 2 points for a win, 1 point for a draw. You'd lost a point, which was upsetting. It was disappointing. But it wasn't the same kind of thing. So while you're totally right, the tactically and technically, we've, especially at the very top level, outgrown the cynicism of, God, we're 1-0 up, let's just defend.
Right.
Where its effect remains is in the emotional quality of dropping 2 points.
And this is kind of what I found interesting, like when you detailed ELO to me, or ELO, because I, like I said, I always feel like it's a little bit, it feels a little bit weird. There was that tweet recently from the Arsenal fan saying, and obviously I don't think it was a joke, but it read in a funny manner, where he says, why is it that we just picked the arbitrary number of 38 games to stop the season at? And I was just like, oh no, like, buddy. And then on top of that, I looked at it and went, actually, why is the league structured? Like, I get it. Like, this makes like a very kind of cursory glance, logical sense kind of thing. But then I started to look into it. I was a bit like, this is the Premier League. Is there no better way? Like, Tottenham have been the best calendar team for 3 seasons from 3 years consecutively, haven't they?
Yeah, there's a brilliant bit in that Mitchell and Webb look, where David Mitchell is walking around as the football Sky Sports promoter.
More football all the time.
More football, it will never end. Who will win the football? No one knows.
Yeah.
And essentially, you have a decision to make. You either decide eventually in 2055, someone's going to win the football.
Right.
And just keep it running till then. Or you're forced to cut your cloth and say, well, hey, this is how seasons work. You also have 38 games. Obviously, it's just because you play everyone twice, home and away. But there is totally an interesting thing in there, which is, well, if the aim is to see who's the best team, right? You might say, okay, 38 games is okay. But the Champions League all of a sudden becomes a very strange way of deciding who's the best team.
So, and that's kind of it as well, is like this is why people want a cup competition during the season as well, or they want them running concurrently, right? Because essentially the Champions League is, the group stage is basically just like a lowering you into a warm bath kind of thing, which I love. I love the group. I love the Champions League. I can't get over it. It's really great in the current format, and I'm sure it'll be just as good in the future format. But the interesting aspect with that is then what you're then really judging in the group, in the knockout stages, are how crunch are you? How crunch time? How clutch is your team that when the pressure is on, then you win, not over 38 games, but over two legs, even over one leg when you only have a little bit left.
And there is the question that I don't have the answer to, but I spend lots of time thinking about.
Right.
If you were clutch, does that mean you were good?
Yeah.
Or instead, and more where I end up, is clutchness just like something that can happen that means you end up winning trophies, but isn't really a reflection of your quality? Like, if you're comparing Didier Drogba, who didn't have a brilliant goal scoring record numerically, but oh my God, he scored every cup final he scored the winner in. How on earth do you assess him versus someone like Harry Kane, who's got twice the scoring record, but has never truly done it, is the feeling, in a cup final or in a crunch match?
I guess there's also, and that's where the ELO thing comes in for me, right? Is obviously I can read out the top ELO clubs and you'll probably get a good idea of how ELO is measured. Though it's kind of a weird one, like, actually reading this, some of them don't make sense. So the top two make sense, right? Man City, obviously, they've just won a treble, right? And they were imperious last season. So the eye test follows the ELO test. Liverpool, second. Pretty consistent season before, pretty inconsistent. I was surprised they didn't drop further off. Though it actually shows the weighting of winning against the good teams with ELO really keeps you high up.
And I should at this point explain how this really works. So ELO is a relative measure of strength. So if you play a team that's the same strength as you, roughly speaking, what ends up happening is if you win, your ELO goes up by about 8 and theirs goes down by about 8. But, and this is the crux, if you play a team that's much stronger than you and you win, your ELO goes up by about 12 or 13 and theirs loses by about 12 or 13.
Right.
In essence, the worse you are compared to your opposition, the less you have to lose and the more you have to gain.
I feel like it could be even more weighted. Like, I feel like that the advent of data in the modern game means we can more accurately rank teams. Now, some people are out there are going to say, you know, the league table reflects who is the best team in the season. That just, we've given what feel like arbitrary measures, but they are, you know, relatively accurate measures. And that's just the way it is. Like, why can't you just accept that? Why does it need to be weighted?
Well, I did have this thought actually during Man City versus Arsenal in March, where City was so dominant. But had Arsenal not dropped some points in the weeks prior, you would have had this weird situation, possibly for the first time in Premier League history. I say that tentatively, I don't know, where the team who was going to win the league was clearly inferior to the team in second. Because had Arsenal been 7 points clear of City or 8 points clear on that day and lost 4-1 as they did, or 4-0 as they did, you'd have gone, yeah, but they're still favourite to win the league. Which would have invited this really complicated question of what is it to be the best? And the reason why I like the league format is because best sounds like a very static measure. Really what you mean is not best today or best tomorrow, but best in a dynamic way over a period of time. And the reason why the league is nice in some ways is because it makes your August as valuable as your March, as valuable as your May. And the team that wins the league overall, you kind of say, well, I don't give a shit if they were the best team in May.
Right.
They were the best team overall. So that's that's essentially the argument for articulated poorly for the league being a good measure of good.
Well, also partly because it's not a closed league, it makes it very difficult to rank teams consistently because say this season or last season you had Bournemouth coming up, right? I, along with everyone else, predicted Bournemouth would be 20th, and the weighting and everything else would have seemed to have suggested that Bournemouth would finish 20th if they'd have continued with the Scott Parker experiment or the Scott Parker experience. Two great bands, by the way. So with that, the Premier League, what I'm saying is I think the league is in a good format. I think it's fine. But imagine if there was this modern data version of the league where these weighted kind of things happen. Like, for instance, City beating Arsenal that day could have put such a difference between them because Arsenal also were weighted better than City at that point. Mm. That would have been like a big, it would have been like a huge land grab for Man City. And would it not also incentivize better games between the big teams because of the amount of ground that you claim if you are big? So in previous seasons, Liverpool versus City would just be so monumental points-wise.
It's Mario Kart. You know, in Mario Kart, when you're at the back, you get all the good boxes.
Correct.
And you have this question where do you prefer, there's two goods we can choose between. Do we want the good of the season truly reflected the strength of the teams, which is just unadjusted 3 points for a win, one for a draw? Or do we want, in the Mario Kart style, the worst teams by performance to have greater prizes by beating the big teams to keep things interesting?
And also, yeah, right. But okay, so I think we're kind of onto something here. I'd imagine we've lost a few people in the conversation, but that's a malaise. So along with that then, I totally understand the weighting thing. Like, you know, if a team is good, playing a bad team, you know, the weighting is huge. You climb up a huge amount of points. Why is it then that Arsenal are fourth? Because I get it, over one season, they're very good. But Real Madrid are behind Arsenal. And Real Madrid made the semi-final of the Champions League last season. Arsenal weren't even in it. Maybe I'm answering my own question here.
It's a great question, and this is the limitation of ELO in the context of football. So with chess, where it's most famously done, it's Jamie versus Lawrence. It's very simple to work out who's better. In football, Lawrence. It's like, well, yeah, well, you know, that's that you don't need ELO for, right? That's right. The beauty of this relationship. Yeah,
right.
So what you end up having is like, well, La Liga, Osasuna are not rated as high as Brentford. By ELO.
How do you have an index to rate either of those sides?
Very easy. By how they played against other sides. Now, eventually you keep asking, okay, well, how did they become stronger in the first place? And the answer is, I don't know, but I assume there's some inherent initial Premier League bias.
It seems to be because Man City, Liverpool, Arsenal, Newcastle, Newcastle are above Barcelona. And I get it, Newcastle relative to Barcelona, in terms of the teams they beat, those kind of things. But Barcelona won La Liga last season.
And this is the fucking folly of trying to essentially do quantitative measures of good.
Right.
And this is why qualitative is what everyone goes to intuitively, right? Like, you don't need to understand ELO to go, yeah, but Barcelona won the league.
I get that. It kind of, after this break, I'm going to tell you why I think it's interesting. So ELO is good. ELO is interesting to talk about. That for me means good, right? I'm not saying it's overall good. I wouldn't say I would rank a team like this. But what's interesting is it doesn't necessarily mean that Newcastle could go to La Liga and win it, though.
It does not.
The same with Manchester United, the same with Liverpool, the same with Arsenal. All these teams are above Barcelona. And Atletico Madrid, by the way, a very strong side.
What it shows is it's very difficult to correctly assess the strength of a team if their opposition is not very strong. So,
right.
Rayo Vallecano are the worst example because they're very underrated, probably. And they're a very good side. But there is an assumption that going to Everton and winning is harder than pitching up to the outskirts of Madrid and getting results at Vallecano. And the reason why Elo is such a niche measure in football is because we understand as football fans, it's more complicated and more dynamic. Something like chess or darts, which is one-on-one, there seems to be many fewer variables that make this a slightly silly niche, albeit very interesting to talk about measure.
Right. Also because it's easier maybe to rank individuals by ELO than it is to rank combinations of 11 and or combinations of 23 out there as 11s.
Yeah, and it's interesting too because I don't think City have scored a goal at Tottenham's new ground.
Right.
That doesn't mean that Tottenham are better than City.
It does. No, I get what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, so Tottenham, by the way, 19th in this list behind RB Leipzig and, weirdly, behind Brentford and Aston Villa.
Okay, so this is worth mentioning. Brentford would have started last year with quite a low ELO.
So this, meaning, every club they beat, a higher grab of land.
A higher grab of land. And Tottenham equally started the season finishing fourth the prior year, quite a high ELO and therefore very liable to lose that land.
Right. So actually, and I'd be interested to know how often the ratings of the sides are therefore reset. Like, are they always relative to the last fixture?
Yeah, so...
Right, so it's constantly reset to a new rating. It's not like at the start of the season, you're weak, and therefore throughout the season, you're weak, because this is why I was going to talk about Bournemouth. Bournemouth come in, Scott Parker, change your manager, change your culture, change everything, climb up higher, predictions change.
And here's the interesting thing. What's the rating, what's City's ELO rating there?
280. Okay. Liverpool's is 950, so it's quite a gap.
So 2080 for City there shows in football... It's kind of hard to be dominant because as dominant as they've been, ELO, which is a mathematical formula, same across sports, the best chess player is trying to get to 2900 ELO. So you have to think about what that dominance is compared to City's.
Right.
And here's the interesting thing. Chess is very drawish, meaning at the top level, when people are good at it, every game is basically a draw. Meaning...
Is that preferable?
No, definitely not. It's a disaster. But
I mean, for the top guys, is that not preferable? Is a draw just not a preferable result for them? So culturally, it's preferable as well.
In terms of ELO, if you're the best and you draw, you lose a little bit of ELO. So you end up having this effect where to get to 2900 is almost impossible. Why? Because you need to win 80% of your games, but 50% of your games are guaranteed to be draws.
So has Magnus Carlsen ever been 29?
No, but it's his big mission. He's been like 28-65. And... Okay, 35 ELO doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're losing ELO basically every game, not because you've lost, because you're so good that a draw damages you.
Which is also the same with the bottom sides and the poor teams here, is like you reach a point where it becomes indistinguishable between the poor sides. So the ELO that you win and lose is also not judgeable. It's not like, yeah, it's not actually a good measure of whether teams are good or bad.
Yeah, it's such a good point. And it's also why... emotionally, a draw for Man City or Liverpool in recent years has just felt like such a disaster. Because, okay, they're not bothered about ELO, the fans, but they're going, Jesus, it is such a loss of land, to use our language, to drop 2 points against Norwich. You know, our strength relative to theirs is so great that we're losing such an opportunity in not getting all 3 points. And one of the advantages of ELO is it really reflects the emotion of Norwich feeling like they've won and Liverpool feeling like they've lost after a 1-1 draw.
So here's what's interesting, right? Is there's some coach ratings on this website as well. You've got the ratings of coaches in terms of, weirdly, it doesn't, I don't understand the current club bit, but there's a table here, right? It says stints. 3-5 for the second coach and 3 for the third coach. So winning stints don't seem all that long at the very top. Games, pretty even up at the top. Career ELO, Pep Guardiola is so high on his career ELO. I think his career ELO is... Oh no, there's someone with a career ELO higher than... Oh, no, it's not. It's almost as high as Pep's. Do you know? So I'll just read you the top five, should we say. Pep, Hans Peser, or Hans Pesser, Jurgen Klopp, Karl-Heinz Feldkamp, Jose Mourinho, and then Antonio Conte is number six there. Zidane has very high career ELO. Klopp's relatively middly, it seems, in terms of these managers. Actually fairly low end in terms of the sort of towards the bottom half. Klopp's career ELO is actually lower than Mikel Arteta.
It's Mainz.
Mainz low as in right. Yeah, he.
The formula here for a great ELO.
Weirdly, Kevin Keegan's still quite high.
You know, Kevin Keegan didn't believe in defensive midfielders.
A lot of things Kevin Keegan doesn't believe in. Very troubling.
I'm assuming vaccines, but I don't know that for a fact. Yeah.
Pretty interesting way, though, to rank all-time managers here. And also kind of, I guess the managers probably wouldn't care about this. Weirdly, Ralf Rangnick, 12th. Bizarre.
Oh.
Yeah.
What's Ralf doing up there?
He's got a lot of games as well. 476.
As a manager?
Seems that way.
That's 12 seasons of solid coaching.
That can't be right.
Well, I mean, he's 65 odd, right? So maybe it's not impossible.
I suppose so. Maybe we're not. Martin O'Neill still quite high up in this list. Graham Taylor still very high up in this list. Rafa Benitez just outside the top 50.
Speaking of Martin O'Neill, I was on the tube the other day and it was like a 25 minute trip underground. So I was like, how many centre forwards can I name that have been capped for England? And I got Gabby Agbonlahor as I was getting off the central line. I was like, yes!
I love that.
And it threw me back to England B teams. Do you remember the England B team?
Yeah.
It was a thing, it was like a mid-2000s phenomena.
I think it was like a thing because of all the young promise that there was, and because we thought we had this like golden generation, you had to tier them because it was like, look, the guys at the top are so good that we could feel, it was almost a brag of we could feel two sides.
And the teams we'd play against were like, I don't know, like I think Lithuania, we used to play Lithuania, Latvia,
Lithuania, pretty good. Lithuania, good team. Sir Alex Ferguson, by the way, in terms of ELO, ELO, 28th, all-time career ELO, lower than Jurgen Klopp.
That's but interesting.
Higher than Hans Pesser, much higher actually than Jose Mourinho. No, lower, sorry, than Jose Mourinho, yeah. Weird.
It is fascinating. Like I'm looking at England B here. You have Gary Pallister with 9 caps as the top most capped player. And you know how Eddie Nketiah has played like 45 times for England under 21s. You get these characters who are like not quite good enough.
A bit patronizing almost. Like Curtis Jones was part of the England under 21s thing.
He's like 29.
Yeah, he's not 29. But he's like 24 or something. Yeah. But you get what I mean.
We should chat that out, by the way. England under 21s just won the Euros.
From a fairly strong position. They're very good side. Well coached.
They didn't concede the goal.
Yeah, they were really good. They were great to watch as well, actually. And Curtis Jones was instrumental in the whole thing, weirdly.
Yeah, and you know, they didn't play centre forward. They played Gibbs White and Anthony Gordon. But then you think, geez, Gibbs White, who's 40 million quid and he's Forest's best player. And Anthony Gordon, who went for about similar money to Newcastle.
And Curtis Jones, who'd probably go for like 30, 40 million himself if he was to go somewhere else in the Premier League.
I mean, if he was to go to Saudi Arabia, he'd be going for 65 mil.
Minimum right now, yeah. I mean, there's a whole other podcast in that. But it's interesting to see like, I guess under 21s, not to get too sidetracked, but under 21 stuff is like, maybe the under 21s thing should be capped at...
21?
No, like price almost.
Yeah, because the 21s, it feels disingenuous to have Jude Bellingham rock out for England if he did, you know?
He should.
There is an argument that like you just play your best players.
If they've qualified and they've become men earlier, age seems arbitrary to define Jude Bellingham.
Did you see in his interview for Real Madrid at this first press conference, there was that journalist.
Who said,
who asked a question. Oh, I can't remember his name now. Covered Spanish football, English guy for ages. Guardian podcast.
Sid Lowe. Yeah.
And he was like, Sid, by the way.
I'm a massive fan. Yeah, good.
I mean, that is the peak
of journalism.
Can you imagine the story of the summer? The golden boy goes, oh, I'm a huge fan of you. Thanks so much for being here.
I wonder how much Sid Lowe made for that. Because that podcast is over now. I think it's like dead podcast. Or at least it's gone. I like Sid. Sid's a good podcaster. Great voice.
I've got to be honest. There is such good football writing. There's just such good football writing and journalism out there. And I don't know whether sport in general still suffers from a kind of snobbery. I assume less and less. But there's sport journalism that wouldn't be out of place in terms of quality, talking about any issue at all.
Probably be ahead of other people's journalism as well. Just, I think it's such a, I mean, Jonathan Wilson, what could he write in? There's a lot of hacks in our space, basically, like very, very good hacks. Wilson, Henry Winter's maybe not so, but like Oliver Kay, people like that.
Yeah, a couple of them have surfaced to The Athletic.
Imagine Fabrizio Romano on politics. Boris Johnson to be prime minister. Here we go.
I don't like how he's worked out the here we go is his brand.
It doesn't, by the way, he said here we go the other night and then said things still being worked out. And I'm like, sorry, no, the here we go. I mean, maybe you get to define it. It's your phrase, but you can't say here we go and then go, still a couple of kinks in the chain here, guys.
No, he's shoehorning here we go in because
he knows it banks. He knows it banks.
I'll tell you something else.
Heineken love it.
You know how many Twitter followers he has?
Go on.
It's like 17 million.
Yeah. Just from people waiting for him to say...
Romelu Lukaku is not going to Juventus.
I would... While we're on the side track, where should Romelu Lukaku go?
He should stay in Italy, ideally. But I had this conversation...
Why not come back to Chelsea?
Well, I had this conversation with a Chelsea fan yesterday. And I said, would you want him back? Not really.
Chelsea fans are a bit weird, aren't they?
And then I was like, what if he had scored a brace in the Champions League final? He scored that Edison chance and scored again an extra time. Would you want him back? Yes. Well, is he not the same player? Yeah. And then this is the irony with sport. What? Avram Grant has gone from joke to legend, or rather legend to joke, because John Terry slipped. Roberto Di Matteo has gone from funky interim to all-time legend.
Yeah.
It's not, I mean, he didn't put the corner in the Drogba scored from. And it made me think, well, maybe with sport, you just have to accept, I'm interested in your view here, you just have to accept that they're at the finest of margins. And people really are good and bad based on things that are so fine.
That's where Elo works out. Elo is kind of a thing. I expected Pep Guardiola to be top. I've got to admit, I didn't expect Jurgen Klopp to be so high. But it's like you said, it's the weighted thing. It's this weighted football thing. It's still obviously a very flawed system as to ranking people, but I'm enjoying it.
Another interesting question is like, how important is it to rank teams over any period of time?
Well, in a holistic sense, like, do we just want football to be okay? I think we were going to have this conversation on another podcast, and I think we've shelved it for another time, but it's like, football, there is an element of football that's about winning. The competitive element is important within football. It's just how long you want that element to be there. Like, do you want it to be there over 38 games? You know, why do your emotions feel so strong in that moment and not as strong 2 weeks later? Like, what are we trying to make football here? Are we trying to prime football to play on our animalistic and sort of instinctive emotions and therefore kind of play into our weakest, most gameable brain functions? Or do we want it where it's like, is the reason we don't do ELO as a group, as an outcome in the league, is because people go, well, we only lost against you, so we don't even lose that many points. It doesn't even seem that bad. You know, it might lead to a lot of dead rubbers in the Premier League because there's a lot of like middling equal teams.
Yeah. And you don't want, candidly, you don't want the league to go, well, Arsenal won the league. I mean, they lost more games than City and won fewer, but by the funky measure of ELO, they've won it. That would feel like a strange open bus tour.
But by the merits of that as well, if they weight the games, then they win more bigger games. They won more quality. The quality of the games they won was better. What if, I'm not even saying it needs to be by ELO. I'm just saying, like, what if there was a qualitative measure of games, rather than just the 3 points, it's like a decimal system after the 3 points, which cumulatively over a season, decimals add up, right?
Right. So the easiest way to do this in theory would be to say, if you beat top of the league, you get another half point. And if you beat bottom of the league, you get no points.
It would also be how far away in the league you are from them, how far away in all these kind of things. So again, there is like a weighting to it, but it's all worked out with AI.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because as soon as you weight things like that, you give meaning to games that potentially didn't have them before.
Right.
So Norwich go to City, and rather than thinking this is just a day in Manchester, they think there is a real free hit here.
Yeah.
Like we have a chance to really eat up some points.
Like we could get 4.1 points if we win against Man City today, because we're 19th and they're first. Like if we beat this side, it wouldn't even have to be first. Like it could be like a form-based thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you could have a mixture of, well, what are the relative difference in positions?
Mm-hmm. Along with form.
Along with the last five games.
And that's kind of it, is like, I often say this at the start of every season, and some people like poo-poo the whole idea. I think it's got weight. The order of the fixtures matters. When you play a team matters. Postponed games in a season, especially last season, matter. Like if City play Arsenal when Arsenal are stronger earlier in the season, is that a draw? Is there a difference in confidence? Like that matters.
Well, I mean, Saliba's available for one.
Exactly.
Queen Elizabeth, I'm looking at you. You can't quite say that on air.
You can't.
It's fine on this podcast.
It's a safe space. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But you know what I'm saying? Like if things don't get delayed last season, it's a lot closer.
Yeah, well, I remember City, Vincent Kompany outjumping Chris Smalling.
Yeah.
1-0 City. They then go in 2-0 at Newcastle and beat QPR on the final day, famously. Had that fixture happened 6 months prior, the momentum that City got from beating United wouldn't have carried them through the hardship
exactly
of St. James's Park and Paddy Kenny and Jerry Barton's Queen's Park Rangers.
Thank you.
I remember, I was actually at Old Trafford the day City had to go to Newcastle, and it's the greatest substitute in Premier League history, is the idea. Is Mancini is in charge of City at the time, and they have truly no room for error. They've got to beat Newcastle away and beat QPR at home, and they take off David Silva and bring on Nigel de Jong chasing a goal, and they go, what the fuck? It's bizarre, but it's to play Yaya Touré further forward.
Yeah,
and he scores a brace and City win the league. And 12 years on, we're sitting here with treble winners Man City. And you can't be so revisionist. You can't be so counterfactual in your assessment of history. But is there an argument that Nigel de Jong on for David Silva
changes it all?
Well, it wins City the league for sure. And what is the relative impact of City not winning the league and United winning it that year and Ferguson staying on? Probably.
Or maybe not Ferguson staying on. Maybe you know, other players just seeing the merit of going to Manchester United.
You know, it's interesting. I think over a long enough time span with City, eventually they were going to be successful, which is one of the reasons why maybe it wasn't so exciting.
Yeah, that felt like an inevitability to the whole exercise.
Is that how it felt? So when I've watched Liverpool, and I'm not a Liverpool fan or a City fan, the reason why it's quote unquote mattered more or felt cooler with Liverpool is because there was the relative jeopardy of like, well, we don't have unlimited money. This isn't eventually going to work just by virtue of the amount of capital we have. Whereas with City, you always slightly got the sense that like...
In the end.
Look, you've picked the perfect manager, built the club to his specs, not only brought in Erling Haaland, but also Julian Alvarez, World Cup winner, when he's not feeling up to it. At some stage, something's going to give.
Maybe it's also just the stories we tell each other. I think a lot of it is like narrative driven. I think, you know, I know Liverpool's net spend and whatever you want to focus on, and there is a reason it all feels that way. I'm sure there's a quantitative and qualitative way of measuring both of those. And I kind of get your question, but I think, I mean, I want to say yes as a Liverpool fan, obviously, but I'm trying to think from a City perspective that, you know, a lot of the things that make Liverpool what they are like old historic cornerstones of the club, like, you know, Shankly, Paisley, all these guys. That's historic spend that just is relatively further away to the modern day, but still people hear their dads talk about it, or they're probably their granddads now, and they go, oh wow, I want to play for Liverpool because of that. Like Liverpool spent a lot of money back in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s in order to get ahead. Is this not just City just doing this now, and in 30 years time it is what it is?
No, it's probably true. I mean, the other thing that comes to mind when you say that is yesterday during the tennis, and we're recording this on the
Monday, the 17th, after the Wimbledon final on the Sunday. Yeah.
They said, it's not just Djokovic you have to play against, the tennis player. You have to play against his reputation. And the same has clearly been true for Liverpool and Anfield, especially in Europe for decades.
Right.
But particularly since 2005. when Liverpool won the Champions League.
So I feel like it was there anyway, because there was like, yeah, so the Gerrard thing when he strikes it injury and the run to the final. But, you know, before that, even then, like 2001, Liverpool won the Europa League, I think it would have been back then. McAllister scores like a last minute free kick, or in extra time, it's a free kick. And I think that's even the golden goal there.
Was that the funky treble, the Carling Cup, FA Cup, Europa League?
Well, we actually won five things in 1 year.
No.
Yeah.
Community Shield
and the Intertoto Cup or whatever it was then, like the World Club Cup or whatever we want to call it. So that's five things in the season.
In your mind, unmatched. How does that compare to a Premier League title that year instead?
It gave Gerard Houllier a glow, which he still deserves. He was a wonderful coach, a wonderful man. By all accounts, many accounts, and it was no Premier League, and that was what we craved, and that was why all the, like, 20 years later, over 20 years later, all that's been eclipsed. But Gerrard was still in that side. Owen was in that side. Was Owen in that side? Yeah, I think Owen was in. Yeah, of course he was. Owen was in that side. There was a lot of young Scousers in that team, or like two young Scousers, and a load of, you know, upheaval and unrest that we all felt.
Yeah, and to bring it back to Elo, right? Like, the Premier League really was the prize. It wasn't a collection of other trophies. And the slight danger of doing things quantitatively as opposed to qualitatively is you lose that. You lose right. You lose the smell test of, it was great, but it wasn't a Premier League.
Right, which it kind of is good and bad, because you look at it and you go, yeah, I kind of want to get rid of that. Oh, it's not the Premier League sort of thing. Because, you know, even Thierry Henry, when talking about Steven Gerrard, goes, oh, but it feels weird that he didn't lift the Premier League. But weirdly, like, I can kind of see it in my mind now.
I mean, like, look, Richie Dalat won the Premier League.
Right.
Fabio da Silva started the European Cup final. Winning stuff as a player is not necessarily indicative of quality. Buffon has never won the European Cup.
Yeah, but Anderson has.
Calvin Phillips has.
Technically.
I mean, how Calvin Phillips feels about his achievements is a fascinating question.
Yeah, being there and being part of it, two different things.
Yeah, just, and then this is me being biased.
Yeah.
Maybe because they're an English side and Scott Carson's had such an impact in the dressing room, just being from Yorkshire and being an English lad has like slightly made him valuable, because there aren't many English threads. I know how that sounds.
It sounds great.
what a soundbite.
I understand what you're saying at this point. Let's take a break and we'll get back to league structures, because I think I've got an interesting place to take this. So as much as I enjoy talking to Scott Carson, let's talk about other international ways of structuring leagues. We did a little research before. By the way, in terms of managers, I think it is interesting to look at a manager's career in terms of like the whole life of it, you know, like Pep Guardiola's life of his whole career is way more interesting than just one or two aspects of it. Like, you know, the same for Klopp, and now that's weighted. The same for Mourinho. I was surprised to see Mourinho so high up in that. It's an interesting one. Let's go now to apertura, clausura. Do either of those terms mean anything to you?
Like, not even flirting with it.
Right, interesting. Because, so, this is the structure of the league in Liga MX. Liga MX, of course, is a, well, I don't want to say it's like, I don't want to say it's an inferior or superior league, but it's one of the more famous leagues in the, do you call them the Americas?
South America? Yeah, the Americas.
Yeah. It sounds a little colonial, but yeah. Anyway, basically, league structure and questioning it is kind of what I'm into here, right? I really enjoy the idea of restructuring the Premier League. Some massive, you know, people have just exploded. Everyone thinks it's amazing.
This is truly a Liverpool fan, having watched his team lose by a point 2 years in a row.
2 years in a row?
Yeah. Mm.
Also, we should talk about that for a second. We'll talk about that in a second, sorry. So anyway, apertura, clausura. You have two halves to the season. There are however many teams in the league. Everyone plays each other once. Apertura. There is then a break. Everyone then returns. Clausura. Everyone plays each other again. The reverse fixture. You then have a winner of that league, right? So you have two winners in that season.
So to contextualize, Arsenal would have won the first half of the season. City would have won the second.
Right. And then two of them then play each other in a final to find like an ultimate champion or champion of the champions.
And my question to you is this. If the first half winner loses the grand final, do they still kind of celebrate the achievement or feel like they've won something in winning the first half? Or does it feel like the first half is just a qualifier for the grand final?
I don't know enough contextually, but I would say they see it as a win, and they see it as like, we are joint league title champions essentially.
Got it.
And then this is like a cup sort of thing. But I find it interesting because like you said, like Arsenal would have got some recognition. City would have got some recognition. Everyone within that season maybe would have got what they deserved almost.
Yeah. And this is where the Arsenal tweet that you mentioned, which was a bit of a joke, is actually kind of funny.
Right.
Like, it is on one level arbitrary to say it's 38 games as opposed to 19 games.
Extremely.
Because after 19 games, everyone's played everyone. So why twice as opposed to once in this context?
Home and away. And you're also kind of finding out, like, you're basically, it is kind of just two halves as well. So what's weird about it is the halves are weirdly related. So obviously they both feed into the final. But in the 19 games in between the two times that you two play the second, so you play in the final, you could have sold players in that time. You could have bought better players in that time. What happens if you win the league twice?
Yeah, I mean, the Six Nations, if you're in Dublin and Cardiff the same year, that sucks, but unlucky. You're not going to have them at the return fixture at your home ground. And we accept that that's fine. So there's no reason to accept that. There's no reason to think splitting the leagues up like this isn't also fine. And it may genuinely be reflective of the fact that in the season, the era of, I don't know, call it July to January, mm-hmm. there was a champion, which was Arsenal.
Right.
They had 50 points that season, which is an achievement.
It's the same as being a centurion, if it's half a century.
Right. And it feels like pro rata, their 100-point season feels relatively unrecognized.
Right. Although weirdly, it is recognized, but you just need really accurate history books. And a lot of people go, well, in the history books, this is not the thing that happens. And it's like, well, weirdly, we have a lot more context in our history books now. We have videos, we have pictures, we have multimedia, we have all these things. If, you know, when we're speaking about people who won and lost the league within the modern context of the culture that we live in, it isn't just about winning and losing the league. Like this Liverpool side, this City side, this Arsenal side, this, what other sides in the Premier League? Maybe even Newcastle, probably not. But like other sides will go down as contextually brilliant sides that were generationally incredible.
Right, and it feels cool to have that recognition because what? Are we saying that 19 teams a season fail in the Premier League? Of course not. Right? Like the fact that so many teams in the Premier League don't win it, all but one,
right,
doesn't feel like an insult or an attack on those teams.
But does it also feel a little bit more winnable for a side who needs to win 19 games to go out there and get something? Because as we said pre-podcast, Newcastle United in the second half of the season went on a... Actually, they went on a pretty poor run, but the first half of the season, obviously, they've been on an excellent run. They were a second at one point. I don't know if they finished there at the first half. But if you're within touching distance of that other side and you've had a terrible first half of the season, you've been all over the place, it makes sense to really push yourselves in those final few games to be at least in that final.
And it has one more nice thing as well, which is teams like Newcastle or Arsenal this year run out of squad depth.
Right.
So at some point, just, you know, because they don't have as much cash, they end up not winning the overall prize.
Right.
But it'd be cool to acknowledge the efforts of the players that were fit for the period they were.
Right.
You know, my friend Sports Arsenal sent a screenshot to me of City bringing on Foden, Mahrez in the port. And he said, why didn't we just do that? Like, why did we just forgot to bring on Foden, Mahrez in the port? And the joke there is like, sorry, well, you had Smith Rowe, you had Reece Nelson.
Trossard.
And you had Trossard. Mm-hmm. And it would be cool to acknowledge the fact that City or Arsenal or Newcastle or whoever don't have the money, but you can still win something. So that accessibility point that you made, I think, is bang on.
And I think it kind of opens things up, right? There are some other stories out here. I think that most of them are just like anecdotal season things, but some people have gone on to do special things because... someone who was 13th placed in the regular season became a champion because they were able to flip the script in the second half of the season.
Wow. And you know, you get stories like that where a transfer window happens, a manager comes in. And, you know, I guess what we're really arguing for here then is just smaller windows of recognition mm-hmm. to account for the fact that sustained success over 38 games is hugely difficult.
Right.
And, you know, Liverpool got 99 points and failed
to be recognised. 97. Oh, yeah, 99. Sure, but 97 is why.
So, you know, I think, Lawrence, you've basically convinced me of the merits.
And that's kind of it, right? Is I feel like, obviously, it massively changes, like, that. Weirdly, it kind of changes all sorts of things. But to an extent, we kind of need... We need a bit of a shift, I think, in the Premier League. Just to weight it a little bit differently. Because what we're finding now is just the sheer level of money and investment and all these kind of things is a roll of the dice, which feels like not really a roll of the dice for a lot of these big guys. But if you roll your dice right for a season, you could do something.
Which is why Leicester was so remarkable.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's why that's probably so the most said
phrase on a football podcast, right?
Right, but it's relevant here because everyone thought, well, you know, they'll drop off. Well, they'll finish top four. Well, they might get Champions League. Well, and eventually in like March, everyone was like, nah, they're going to do it. But the reason it took until March is because we all had this recognition intuitively of how difficult is it to sustain it over that period of time.
Right.
And how lucky do you need to be with injuries?
The same for Spurs, the same for all these people.
You know, it is interesting. Maybe it would be less rewarding to win half a league because part of the reason why winning the league is so fun or rewarding is it's so arduous and difficult.
And exhausting.
And exhausting. And 38 games is such a long time. And you need to find solutions. And players do get injured. And maybe I worry that we're taking away from some of that.
I get what you're saying. But then what if you have a position where you're basically, we're like, well, what if for the next 10 years City dominate it? Or just someone comes in and dominates it?
You know, the Bundesliga were thinking about a playoff final. Even Bayern were kind of into it because they were thinking 10 leagues in a row is no good for anyone.
But yet they realize after a while that you have to have that level of competition. Otherwise, people begin to tune out. The money changes, the sponsors get less interested, all these kind of things.
But then we should just be honest about what we're suggesting, which is we're wanting to introduce jeopardy because over 38 games, it's essentially too egalitarian. Like you are essentially... without these supportive measures, you're genuinely just seeing who the best team is in real terms. But because of the wealth and the quality in the game, that might be an uninteresting way to do your football.
So then what happened, which is why Scotland has their system?
Yeah, right. So Scotland splits after everyone plays each other three times. And the fourth fixture you play is, if you're in the top six, only against fellow top six sides. And if you're in the bottom six, only against fellow bottom six sides.
Right.
That leads to the quirk of if you're Ross County and you finish sixth, and now a third of your remaining fixtures, or 40% of your remaining fixtures, are Celtic and Rangers, you're very likely to finish on less points than the team who finished below you at seventh, because they're playing
The weighted thistle. Yeah, right. Week in, week out, whereas you've got Celtic. But you have the big games. So is the reward not the big games in that sense and the chance to punch up and those kind of things, unless the gap is obviously so big at which point that you can't really reach the gap.
But the other thing is it keeps it interesting because now sixth is a prize. So now you have less dead rubbers for mid-table teams because mid-table teams are actually kind of the most interesting.
But it would make it interesting then that we keep talking about this, like tiering the Premier League in that sense. Like, so would you do the Premier League with, obviously you've got the winner of the Premier League. You don't need to play off for that. You could have a playoff final if you wanted. Maybe it'd be interesting, like if there's a points difference of below this amount between the two teams, you have to have a playoff. So if it's like, say in the Liverpool season, there's 1 points difference, or the Arsenal season, it's like 2 points, 3 points. It's like, listen, that's one game. In this one game, you two play each other and you decide the Premier League.
It is interesting because what you're really optimizing for there is let's keep it interesting as long as we can.
Right.
What you're losing is the fact that over 38 games, one team has objectively done better than the other. And you're having to, like in the championship with the playoffs, accept that the team that finishes third might not go up and the team that finishes sixth might, because we're wanting to keep things alive. No one's doubting that the team that finished third, I mean, Notts County in the conference is an extreme example. They finished 27 points above Bournemouth, I want to say, and were 1 minute from going up to them.
So, but okay, then my question on top of that is then, do you want it to be more interesting or do you want it to be more equitable?
And that's essentially the tension as far as I see it.
The balance between the two. How do you balance that?
But the equitable point is interesting because while it feels more equitable to not play with incentives and say, well, let's do playoffs, etc., there is a level of equity that you're introducing, which is you're not starting on an even footing. You're starting with one team like Notts County spending a fortune compared to Boreham Wood. So maybe equity actually is giving Boreham Wood the opportunity to have a playoff game.
Like Wrexham.
So, you know, you might well say, well, it's ridiculous that, you know, Wimbledon got promoted in 2016, finishing seventh that year. And we beat Accrington in the semi-final, who finished fourth. Now, you might say, well, that's inequitable. But hang on, if Accrington Stanley were Portsmouth with their budget, wouldn't it be very equitable to give a fan-owned club a pop at them?
Right. But yeah, okay. So we're kind of wandering into moral areas here where it's like, I feel like there's a whole other podcast. In a second, I'm going to pitch you another format and we'll see whether you like it. Here's a question. How do you tier the Premier League? Do you even need to tier the Premier League? Could you put it in conferences? So they don't even have to be geographical. NFL doesn't necessarily follow geographical in the same way. Conferences, they kind of, people drift between conference to conference because of purposes, political purposes, playing purposes, all these kind of things. People get shifted between conferences. It doesn't happen all the time, but it happens enough for it to be, you know, relevant. In the NBA, purely set. You're in the Western Conference or you're in the Eastern Conference. Very difficult to go between the two unless maybe you move your franchise, right? But it's logistical, first of all, because you can only fly so far. And also, you know, it makes it easier in the playoffs. It's just, there's some kind of local rivalry, right?
So what's the advantage of doing so?
The advantage of doing so is you kind of get these multiple different ways of judging the teams, right? So over a regular season, which is in the NBA, it's a very long season, 83 games. And then it's 17 games in the NFL.
So one of the nice things obviously about English football and the Premier League is the variation.
Yeah.
One week you go to the Emirates, it feels very different to going to Goodison Park.
18 games, sorry, in the NFL. I knew I was saying something wrong. You get one bye week though, so yeah.
Do we worry that we lose that variation if you go conferences?
Well, my question is how the conference is split. So do they have to be geographical? Most people go north versus south, but you could go north, south, east, west. You could also go northwest, north, east, southwest, southeast, but then what's southwest repping?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like a flatmate of mine is a big Mets fan. They're not in the same conference as the Yankees.
Yes.
So it's not necessary. But the question I have about this is like, I like the geographic contrast in the Premier League. I like the, what time did you get up to the Newcastle fans who have just arrived at Bournemouth?
Right.
And my fear about splitting the Premier League into conferences is you lose the variation. And in fact, you get the Scottish problem, which is you play too many games against each other.
Right. So there's a case of almost burnout.
I think so. I think it's nice that you have such variation in geography.
Is there not the problem also in the Premier League at the moment, maybe just to offer the opposite side to that argument, that there's not enough familiarity between some teams and therefore, you know, like the reason Liverpool and Chelsea really do dislike each other is because over, I don't know how many seasons was it, they played each other so intensely that it became like, oh, we hate these guys because we keep losing. Like, you know, if Palace kept playing Newcastle and there was this rivalry that was almost like cooked up purely from the volume of games and those guys just disliking each other, what then? Of course, there is the opposite that could happen where they just become completely apathetic to the other person and, you know.
Right. I mean, Scotland and Israel played each other like 5 times in 2 years and all they developed was an apathy. I would argue in the case of Chelsea and Liverpool, the thing that made that rivalry big wasn't necessarily the frequency of games.
High stakes.
It was the jeopardy.
Yeah.
Because if you look at Stoke and Port Vale, for instance, they're City, that's a derby. They're both in Stoke. Yeah. They play each other never. And when Stoke under-21s visited Port Vale under the Robbie Williams stand in the Johnson's Paint Trophy, they sold out.
Right.
And the away end popped off and it was a huge deal. So I'm not convinced by the argument that familiarity breeds rivalry. I think football fans are remarkable in their ability to keep grudges. Leeds and Chelsea are a great example.
Yeah.
That's a heightened fixture, but no one was alive really to see why that rivalry developed.
But your dad is and your dad passes that down, those kind of things. I guess what I'm saying is like, maybe we're happy with where we're at, but what if there was a regular season that then went into a postseason where, I mean, this is the other good question. Like, okay, so you've not poo-pooed that, but you know, I think you're probably right.
I'm being conservative and traditionalist, and no one's impressed.
But what if you then just said to yourselves, okay, well, we have a regular season champion, we have someone like Man City, and then there is a whole other, system of games which is played based on where you've finished in the Premier League, and you know, it's tiered somehow. So you know, it's top four, middle, second four, third four, bottom four.
Yeah, and that became like a cup equivalent, like in terms of importance.
And you were kind of paired off with other people in some kind of weighted category. So the top four would obviously not get the bottom four, but maybe they get like the second to bottom four, and then the bottom four would get like the middle set, and then you'd have to carve them up. But you get my point.
Yeah,
like,
it is interesting.
There's obviously someone for everyone because you've got equal amounts of teams.
Yeah, it is interesting. Like the other thing you could do is, this is a silly idea. You could take the teams that finish first and 20th, pair them, 19th and second, pair them, third and 18th, pair them, and have to do a combined 11, and then see whether whether the team that finishes 10th and 11th, five players, six players, is stronger than the combination of City and who finished bottom this year? And why don't I know that by hand?
Oh, Southampton.
Southampton.
Yeah.
You know, is the City Southampton side stronger or weaker than the Palace Fulham side?
Doesn't City just take Lavia back?
Yeah, exactly.
It's also then who's coached by Pep for a few weeks. Like, whose facilities do you use? Does City have to go to Southampton for a little while? And maybe...
Well, you know, I haven't heard about this for a couple of years now, but City were going to build a Etihad mini complex in London. And they were going to stay there for all their Southern games. So the idea is the pitches were the replica of the training ground pitches. The hotel rooms were the replica of the hotel rooms at the Etihad training complex. And just they would rather than having home game, before every home game, they do the same thing. And now before every Southern away game, they would do the same thing, exactly the same. So it would be a replica of the Etihad training complex in London for all the Southern games. It's a bit of a side note, but I'm fascinated by the idea.
Yeah, I hate it because it's the sheer amount of money that you need to replicate your training complex
in the south of England for away games,
right? And there's like a decadent sort of thing where you're like, how is that fair? Like, can you really do that?
There's also this
should
marginal...
teams, by the way, be forced to stay in hotels? Should they be forced not to? They should only be able to have one training ground or something like that. There should be like limited amounts of what they can have, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I like the idea of the like marginal gains, where it's like you're so good at football. You've got so much capital. You're looking on ways to improve marginally.
By building basically a hotel with a football pitch.
Yeah, just because then you have the exact same routine. I think it's 9 games they'd have used it for. So all of a sudden, 20 a season. So it would have been 28 games now. They'd have the home experience.
Right.
And 9 games, they'd have the other away experience.
That's insane. To me, I mean, it's not insane, it makes perfect sense, but it's insane in terms of the amount of money that would take in order just to basically get a marginal difference. And even then, it's like, listen, you lose to Wolves, build one in Wolves. Build one in Wolverhampton.
Yeah, don't give them ideas.
Multiple different hotels.
No, I mean...
Etihad chain, I wouldn't mind. Like, you know, if it was like... No, even then, I'd mind it.
You know what I'm thinking, I assume, and I could be wrong, Mahrez sleeps in the same hotel in Manchester... Same room before every, you know, it's room 503.
Right.
Maybe there's a 503 in London for Mahrez, and maybe there's a 503 in the Midlands for Mahrez.
Similar to when you, I don't know if you've ever stayed at a very high-end hotel. Super high-end.
Never super high-end.
Well, I guess you have to do it consistently, but the thing with consistent, apparently high, some of the consistent high-end hotels, and obviously when they welcome back like regular guests, some of these guests, I don't know if this is still the case, but I've been told it by certain people. They have their rooms laid out in such a way that the hotel, and obviously make so much money from it, that they note how they have their room laid out, and they note they keep clothes with that hotel. So like
that's
the Ritz,
crazy.
I guess, will store some of your clothes, or like, you know, they'll lay them out in a certain fashion. So maybe you can have them sent ahead. They'll have pictures that are laid out in your room, those kind of things.
This reminds me of a sort of strange Lincoln. Bernardo Silva got married this summer, and there's a picture of, I want to say, Zinchenko, Cancelo, Jesus, like, you know, like all these old City players. And the comment on the photo was, Pep's got them so well drilled, they're in formation even in the photo.
Wow.
And, okay. they genuinely were.
Wow, that's so
you had Kyle Walker on the right, Cancelo on the left, Jesus at the front of the picture, wow. Bernardo Silva tucked in on the right.
I love that. I love that Cancelo was invited.
I was thinking this as well, right? Like,
training ground bus stops.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Like, obviously, you play against each other in a European Cup tie. And it's like, well, we'll see who Panado's.
Mm.
And it brings, you know, I won't go down this route, but there's a story of Bielsa going to the wedding of a player in Argentina. And the wedding was on the Saturday, end of the game of Sunday. And after the ceremony, a 2.5 hour meeting, which was agreed beforehand with the groom.
Really?
All the players and Bielsa and his staff, all the Metoxes and stuff, doing the pre-match analysis.
Wow.
And that was part of the permission. He wasn't allowed to get married in season unless that was part of the deal.
Why the worry to get married in season? I guess there's got to she was pregnant for sure. There was some sort of pregnancy.
Yeah, it's getting more and more South American and religious. And
right. Jesus is involved somewhere. I don't know where it is.
Probably Jesus is generally involved when it comes to South American football.
Yeah.
And as a secular Jewish boy, I'm always like, it feels exotic. I want to get in more. I want to understand more about it.
Yeah, there's a documentary in there, like whether religious players are more successful or not, or all those kind of things, and why.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, right?
Religious players.
Like, you know how footballers have kids young? Like, I think Garnacho is about to have a kid.
Does he have a kid?
He's about to.
Bro.
I know, and Foden's got a couple of them.
Does it make you more of a target, maybe, to get pregnant from? I mean that in the nicest way. I'm not saying that about Garnacho or Foden. I'm sure they love their kids very much. But, like, you know, there is this motivation to lock a guy down or to sort of be in a long-term relationship with them, and, you know.
It's possible, but I think the other variable is footballers live very uninteresting lives.
Right. So there's like a cocktail of things here. It's not just like, I mean, she snared him. It's like, well, he probably did have a really close, loving, affectionate relationship with you, misogynist.
I mean, McAllister was saying post-World Cup, he trained, pre-World Cup.
Gary McAllister was saying.
No. Your pal Alexis.
Yeah.
He was saying before the World Cup, he used to train at Brighton and then go home and rest. And now after the World Cup, he trains at Brighton and goes home and rests.
Right.
His life isn't particularly interesting in like a young 20s hedonistic kind of way. So it makes total sense. You like have a childhood sweetheart and
you love her.
You love her. And like the next girl you're meeting is someone you're embarrassed to be snapped by the paps with in a Las Vegas club.
Sure.
Shout out Marcus Rashford. It's worth saying he was single. Him and his fiance have broken up.
What, recently?
Recently.
Yeah, which is why he's pictured on a boat with, who is that other guy who's not, was it Anthony?
Did you see the photo of Lucas Hernandez?
No.
It is the most Lucas Hernandez. Like, I don't know the man personally, but he's on a massive boat, obviously, with amazing hair, bleached blonde, looks like such a footballer, full sleeves of tats, smoking a cigarette with sunglasses on, and a female friend in a fairly compromising position.
Wow.
And you think, this is exactly what footballers should be up to over the holidays. This is, you know, this is just a canon event. You know, like you finish up with your season with Atletico Madrid. Yep, straight onto the yacht.
Away you go.
Away you go.
I feel like it's also like a cultural thing, right? Like, you know, weirdly, like Michael Jordan smoked a cigar, but if you saw like players in the modern age doing it, like we have seen some players doing it and people like had a go at them and were like, keep your body at maximum, you know, oxygen efficiency, these kind of things. Like the guy probably sleeps in one of those tents, you know, what's that called? A hyperbaric chamber, where it basically maximizes your oxygen based on, you
know. Yeah, and I might regret saying this on air. There was an article, and I'm quoting here, I swear to God, talking about the appeal of Jack Grealish in the City team. And the idea was essentially that the City team are very...
I think I remember this, yeah.
Very mechanic and brilliant. So to have, quote, and I swear to God it's a quote, Birmingham's most prolific fingerer,
wow,
out on the left flank, gave them some kind of personality.
Yeah.
And you know what I love about that description is that he's had a girlfriend, the same girlfriend since he was 16.
Doesn't
stop him being
But it doesn't stop him being perceived as such.
You know, this is the last Grealish thing. After the Euros in England, he went from like very, very famous to like household name for non-football fans. And the first thing he did is he went, who played Charlotte Big Jugs in the in-betweeners? Emily Attack. Let's have a relationship with her for 6 weeks.
Well, I thought he was with a girl.
Yeah, he was.
Oh, but he also had a relationship with her.
And you just think this is like prime Englishness or something. It's like the least possible imagination. Who was the attractive girl in the in-betweeners and who won Love Island 2 years ago? That's what he did.
Who did win Love Island 2 years ago?
You're asking the wrong person.
Jack Grealish, Love Island winner. I mean, to be fair, that could just be a title. How's Jack Grealish linked to the Love Island? Love Island. Oh, Emily Attack. He's got a type.
He has it. But you know what I like about it too is, of course, that's his type.
Her name's Sasha, by the way.
Sasha. Yes, that's Sasha. His long-term girlfriend. To whom I can only apologize. I mean, I'm sure she's a regular listener of the pods. Yeah. I can only apologize.
Jack and Sasha, pictured here at last year's World Cup, have been dating since school. So wait, sorry, I don't understand what happened here. Jack Grealish, blah, 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 Jack Grealish's legs, blah, Jack Grealish's thighs, while dating fiercely loyal child of sweetheart on off since 2016, Jack's also been linked to Love Island stars and the in-betweeners star Emily Attack. Oh, his girlfriend looks very sweet.
No, she looks, I think dating Jack Grealish would be as sweet as the dude he seems would be a total nightmare.
The blonde beauty was heartbroken when their rumoured fling came to an end. Oh.
I have a friend at Wimbledon who I go with, and he looks like Jack Grealish. So much so that he doesn't really, but if you don't know football well, he does. And the amount of times on a Saturday afternoon at Liverpool Street Station after an away game, I've had to stop in the pub as a group on a hen do, want to take photos with him one by one, is unbelievable.
I like that.
You've got to book it. You have to account for your Jack Grealish selfie time. Whereas I think I slightly have the unfortunate thing of looking like, do you remember David Silva when he had the bad haircut?
I like that haircut.
You know,
I liked it. It was a style at the time.
It was a style at the time. It hasn't aged well.
Hard to find hairstyles that have aged well.
Whereas you know who you could look a bit like? Who was the centre half who was great for Greece in 2004 with the hair? Do you know who I'm getting at?
Kyriakos.
No, not quite. He played for Bolton for a bit.
It might be Kyriakos. Greece... 2004.
Lawrence McKenna. Maybe someone online's already made the link.
Someone compared me to someone I just didn't want to be. Was he in the 2004 squad?
He was, yeah.
He would have been. Was he old?
I mean, maybe you need to off air go through the lineup and just match yourself.
Yeah, maybe I will. Yeah.
But I mean, actually, you know, you're a man. You're a man who's been in the public eye for
a
while.
I'm a man.
Do you get compared aesthetically to anyone?
So today someone compared me, someone said to me, and I was it upset me a little bit. They said, oh, you look like any of them from Jackass. And I felt like personally attacked. Just because everyone in Jackass is having a hard time.
Like any of them is such a good
look. Like the guy said, like, oh, you could be Chris Pontius. And I was like, fuck off.
Fuck you, I could be Chris Pontius.
I don't want to be Chris Pontius.
Aren't you a bit cool to be Chris Pontius?
Maybe, but then Chris Pontius looks a little bit bloated.
That's what I mean. I think you're not a little bit cool to be Chris Pontius.
Maybe, maybe not. He lives in Pasadena. I mean, that's something to aspire to.
Well, I don't know if it's a consolation at all. I think you're a little bit cool to be him.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Watch yourself. So the funny thing is, right, you could then go into a playoff thing where you go 1 versus 20, 20. I think it's over there. 1 versus 20, 20 versus 1, right? And within the 1 versus 20 or the 20 versus 1, so you have 19 versus 2, 3 versus 17 or 18 and vice versa, right? And then from there onwards, it would just become more and more and more clear who was the best team in the league. Because obviously, if you were to have Southampton versus Man City, it would just be interesting to see if in a one-off whether Southampton could beat Man City or like last season, you know, one of the bottom three, like a Leeds or someone like that could have beaten Arsenal in a one-off game. And, you know, that's interesting. But on top of that, how often in a playoffs is the most amount we can watch a team play each other? Could a team play the other team, like in the NBA, 7 times potentially?
With one aggregate score running through.
Wow, that's cool. Oh, I like that. Yeah. Although that could get messy. What I'm saying is, could it be, is 7 too much for football? Like, is it best of 5? Is it best of 3?
It's best of 3.
Why is 7 too much? Like, just 7 is just saturation of football. They know each other too well by that point.
How long are basketball games?
48 minutes.
Okay. I think that's the answer. If you double it, it's a lot of repetition.
So halve it.
Yeah.
Right, so 3.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get you, yeah.
I like one aggregate score though.
One aggregate score over 3 games, I think, is much more interesting.
Yeah. Because
you're only really adding half more to the other aggregate scores. Home and away goals.
The only thing is it might make the first game totally redundant and totally cagey. Like we spoke earlier about the 3 points versus 2 points incentives. If you're having 3 games, the first game is just don't mess it up.
First game at home.
Second game away. Third game away.
Third game. Villa Park, neutral venue.
Yeah.
Dubai, Australia.
Villa Park.
Lahore.
Villa Park.
Villa Park's one of them.
Yeah. I like the idea that you could, oh, lame, you know, we're off to Birmingham. Oh, unlucky lads, we're off to Dubai.
It would be such a big way. It would be such a massive money spinner. It, like, I'm not even kidding. Like, they don't even need to do it in England. You could do this over a course of 5 weeks in America.
One more idea here too. Albeit it might favor the big teams too much. No players can appear in all three games.
Ooh.
So now it's all about the squad. So
that really does favor the big sides.
So you might have to select.
Even goalkeeper.
I think even goalkeepers. And then there's, okay, let's just run this experiment. Even goalkeepers, when do you play your second choice? First game, you assume. Maybe second game, I don't know.
Third game seems too crunch.
Agreed.
First game seems relatively crunch. I think second game, I mean, it would change the tactics entirely anyway in that game, but I get your point. Second game seems like the apex.
Here's the other question. Knowing that you're not going to play your worst goalkeeper in the third game, if you start your first choice in game one, the opposition know he's going to start in game two. And in these lineups, I wonder how much of it is, well, if I think Wimbledon are better than Liverpool in this world, maybe I'm safest in trying to play my bad team the same week Lawrence plays his bad team. And maybe, like, there's this game theory of when is Lawrence going to play his weakened side, and I want to match him.
I also think goalkeepers at the higher level, second choice goalkeepers, like Liverpool have got Kelleher, fairly good backup. Man City had a fairly good backup, Ortega, the American.
Zach Steffen dropped well off.
Yeah.
But Ortega didn't concede a goal, I don't think, in the FA Cup run.
But Zach Steffen's still a very good goalkeeper, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. He's been usurped by Matt Turner, but Michael Carrick still fancies him.
Right. Right. Manchester United, obviously, they'd have ended up keeping whoever that other goalkeeper was, the one who went to Forest.
Henderson.
And then, there would have been some other, you know, motivation there, I guess, to keep a fleshier squad.
Yeah, I am interested now in this idea of three aggregate games and what that would do to... I mean, the only thing you don't want to do is devalue a goal. So you don't want to win the first game 1-0 and think, well, you know, we're a third of the way through.
Depends on how defensive you are. Like, I suppose broadly now, the meta of the football probably will mean that it would play out, how can I put it, like, in such a fashion that even if you won 1-0, you'd be like, okay, well, if Liverpool win 1-0, if City win 1-0, maybe it doesn't mean all that much. But actually, that's, you can come back from that if you're a team lower down the league.
Yeah, right. Okay, so actually, rather than devaluing it, it keeps it alive for longer.
Yeah.
Although, you know what the slightly sad thing would be? Let's say you lose the first game 6-1 and it's over and you still have to play two more games. It's the equivalent of being hammered on the first day of a test match in cricket.
But all you need to do, though, is win the second game 2-0, and then the third game is gettable.
Right. It's a little bit like being 2-0 down at half time. You just need one goal by the hour.
It's not even half time. Yeah.
It's not even half time.
Yeah.
Okay, let's finish up with this following question.
Fine.
For this section, at least.
No, this is the final.
This is, yeah. If you're Guardiola, you're playing Real Madrid in this third.
This was just the Premier League, but I'll let you off.
I appreciate that. Which game does Erling Haaland not play?
I think you psych them out and do game one.
Really? Alvarez up top?
Yeah. Yeah. Still incredibly strong.
I was going to say, they're absolutely fine.
Because also, if they score loads in the first game, then you go, oh, here comes Erling Haaland. Bam. And they go, oh, shit.
On FIFA, I'm on the big thing of not playing my three best players. And then on the hour, you bring all three of them on fresh. And it means if you're drawing at that point, you feel like you're winning.
Is that too late?
Don't know. But it's fun to feel half like... time. It feels like it's fun to feel like you're back. So it's fun to feel like you're winning at 0-0.
Right.
Which you are if your three best players are on the bench.
How often does it result in a goal?
Well, so it's interesting. Very often they end up being involved in goals and you think, should I just not have started them?
Right.
You're stuck between, am I a genius for having benched them or am I an idiot for not having started them?
I get you. Okay. All of this made sense in some capacity or another. Thanks a lot for listening to our brilliant competition theories. The Premier League is a great format. And for years and years and years, it will continue to be a good format. However, in future, we will see if it changes. Same with the Champions League. It's nice to chat to you, Jamie. Thanks a lot for everything.
Thanks for having me.
See you again in a future podcast, guys. Thanks a lot for listening to this one.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.